And we're going to run the presentation too. So I think we're recording. And I think we're good. All right. Take it away.
All right. Welcome, everyone. My name is Greg Palmer. I'm the principal at Searsport District Middle and High School. And Jerry's going to help us present today. And Dawn Staples Knox, a great science teacher who taught both in the middle school and has been now in the high school for several years, is also going to help present. We're going to kind of rush through this. It is feasible that if someone in the room has seen this presentation before, we've given it a couple of times, and so we've tried to condense it but keep the information intact. And what we want to do is we want to get to the end as quickly as possible, because then we want you to take a look at a new piece of our reform, which is a standards-based graduation policy that we recently was adopted by our school board and was recently approved by the state of Maine as the first such policy. And we'd like to get feedback from you and just have an interactive conversation about that policy and see, kind of mine that policy with you and see what you think the implications of it are. Tell us so we can understand what the implications of what of it is. See what we've done. What have we wrought? So I'm just going to do some background information about what we're up to in Searsport. These are some things that are true about our school. We have standards for graduation in lieu of, it kind of goes with, in lieu of the Carnegie unit. Having standards, I was in this room for the previous presentation, which was really wonderful, from Nashua North, and they talked about standards. One thing that's a little bit different about us is that we eliminated the Carnegie unit and only students only meet standards to graduate for us. We have 57 academic standards that students are responsible for graduation. We have some other standards that are non-graduation standards, but there are 57 of them that they have to meet in order to graduate in our school. We have common rubrics, but when we use that phrase, we don't mean a research rubric that everybody uses. That's a type of common rubric that that NEAS talks about, and we have those as well. We've got a research rubric and you know, four or five common rubrics that people think of when they think of the word common, but our common rubrics mean specific rubrics for specific summative assessments in our core program that all students get. So you're giving an assessment in science, since Dawn is here to use that example, and that it's a summative assessment. All students have a rubric they receive prior to that assessment, specifically about that assessment, that's aligned to our standards, and every student in our school will get that assessment before they graduate. That's why it's common. So when I talk about common rubrics, I'm not talking about four, we're talking about hundreds of rubrics that are common. We changed our grading system, and I think if you're here, one of the reasons maybe is because you want to hear about standards-based grading. And we have changed that quite a bit. What we did was we eliminated averaging. There's a lot of talk about averaging today. That is, averaging, I think, is an issue on the table that we don't address directly. So I think averaging is being discussed a lot today without discussing it. So, and you know, people are talking about state scores, and they're talking about cut points, and all of those things tend to be averages. Even your rank in your state is an average, where you rank vis-a-vis other people. What's the average state score, and where do you rank in comparison to that average? I always think that's interesting because the state cut points that you are trying to meet and beat are fictional. Right? They're an amalgam of all the scores and all the schools in your state. No one actually has that score. So it's kind of a fictional target in a way. And we have interventions. What we realized after we put all those standards in place, we thought that all kids would meet them and life would be good. We just built it. And then it took about 12 seconds for us to realize that wasn't going to be the case. So we created standards and students immediately didn't meet them. Like, they held up their end of the bargain. So we had to construct a systemized set of interventions that is different, I think, because of its organization and its the way it flows. It's very organized. It's very systematic and systemic, and everybody's pulling on that blanket a little bit together. No one's running around trying to catch kids individually. And there are two types of interventions we go through. The reason we got into this business was, and we're heterogeneously grouped. So the reason we got into this business was that things weren't good. We didn't set out to change things that were good. We kept those things and tried to add some value to them, but we got into it because there were some problems. We knew that of 20 kindergarten students in Maine who start kindergarten, two will matriculate from a four-year college 17 years later. So those were the odds. And, you know, if we were running a business, we'd be out of business. Those weren't Searsport statistics. Those are regional statistics. David talked about graduation rates and getting everybody to graduation. But there's a problem with that as well. We can graduate 100% of kids, but what happens to them? Bless you. We can also send every kid to college. But what happens after that first semester? So we wanted to get kids to matriculate. That was one of those facts that caused us. It's going to go by itself. This thing has a mind of its own. So what we also knew, he mentioned this today, we knew that every time a student took a remedial course, once they took those placement exams, they had to take a remedial course, their chance of matriculating from that college for each single remedial course they took was 30%. It was a 30% tax every time you took one of those courses. Kid comes out of your school, and they take three remedial courses, and they're done. They have to have an immense amount of fortitude if they take one. They take three, they're done. Practically speaking. Two, the odds are stacked way against them. One, the odds are stacked against them. So we had to get out of the business. For us and for most high schools, the percent of freshmen repeating a high school course was... Ta-da! I've just figured this out. You've got a remote control. I'm like, great, we got the haunted room. So.
I just wanted you to believe that your coach was magic.
Yeah. Well, I knew that anyway, but I'm like, God wants me to go faster, is what I thought. So 12% of our freshmen were repeating a course after the freshman year. That would go up to 14%, and that's probably true in most high schools. Well, we know that's true in most high schools. That, again, wasn't specifically a Searsport statistic. It was true of us, but it's true of most places. I want to just pause for a second because I'm not going to remember to say this again. That is now a little less than 2% in our school. And I want you to understand why. And in a second, we're going to go through a couple of things that we did that were cornerstones to our reform. But this, I don't mention this one, and it gets into the interventions with Plato, too, because we never quite know what to say about Plato. The reason that fewer than 2% of kids now repeat courses isn't because they all complete them exactly when they're supposed to. So if it makes you a little crazy to think about a student at the end of what you determine to be the experience, that they're not complete, and therefore they should go back to the beginning and start over again, then you're not going to like what I have to say, which is that if a student is two-thirds complete at the predetermined time that we say the experience is over, the experience isn't over. We stopped, in a way, determining when the experience was over. And we decided to say the experience was over when the student's learning was complete. So now, if you're two-thirds of the way done Don's course, we have a plethora of options for you. One of which is Plato Learning Systems. And there are lots of those online systems. That's one that we use. So Don has gone in and identified in Earth and Environmental Science the Plato mods that align to her course. So she knows if a student is 60% done her course, or 66%, or however much percent they're done, she knows what they've not completed. And we can assign those mods to that student. And they can complete those mods and be done with the course. Or she can assign a packet of work herself if she thinks that Plato's not appropriate. Or there are a whole bunch of options you'll hear more about. But what I'm saying ultimately is that in a standards-based system, I came to realize this slowly and then it dawned on, finally I got it. A standards-based system is modular by design. It's modular learning. A traditional system is you got to swallow the whole thing. And if you don't, we're going to go back and start over and try to make you choke it down again. And so that's an inherent difference. And anyone who's uncomfortable with that concept, I don't think should get into the whole standards-based design.
Oh, no, I'm not going to touch
that. All right, so also this. This also got us in this business. The most powerful predictor on the SAT, some people might have seen this before. So if you've not seen this presentation before, what if I gave you one piece of information about a student and said, predict how they do in the SAT based on this piece of information, what's the best information I can give you about that kid?
Zip code.
College Board, you know, if you're in the other presentation, I always say this as a joke, but the other presenters said it literally. Their scores went way up, and the College Board came to their school. If you beat the odds, if you beat the zip code odds, what you get for your trouble is an investigation. It's what happened to Jaime Escalante on the AP exam. Those kids blew that test away. They were immediately investigated. Kids aren't supposed to beat the zip code. College Board has figured that public education is incapable of beating a student's socioeconomic heritage. That's the gambit. And if you do it, people are suspicious. So that caused us, that angered us, and caused us to get into this business as well. Okay. So here are some statistics for us in the past. Our kids took the SAT, and in Maine, the SAT is the test we take for AYP. We don't do the kneecaps in high school. They take the SAT. And so you're going to see some SAT data and some PSAT data, but just supplant that with kneecap or whatever your state test is. So our kids took the test, and I put that statistic up there because our kids took the test at a higher rate than most districts. They came and they took the test. And we have a high degree. Every school in America says that we have a higher rate of identified students than anybody else. Even if they've got one kid in 1,000, they say, well, if it wasn't for all those special ed identified kids, this would be okay. Our rate is a little higher than the state of Maine, and that statistic to me means really absolutely nothing. The one that matters is the economic disadvantage. If you take that percentage, I'm going to show it to you later on at the end of the presentation, we talk about results. You take that percentage and you look at your kids who do not meet on your state exam, and those numbers are extremely close. Very, very, very close. So I can tell you now that about 40% of our kids were in the lowest category on the state exam. And it's true of you too. You just have to look, you have to find out what your economic disadvantage number is and paste it up against your exam results, and you'll see that those are the same. And that's something that the College Board knows, and that's why zip code determines how you're going to do on those exams. Okay. But that's a blank one. I realized we had a blank one. There was a snowstorm. So reversing, but what we knew is that reversing those facts is possible. There's lots of great stories about schools that have beaten the odds, broken ranks, all of that. So we did some things to try to make that true. In case you've seen this before, Jerry spiffed up our presentation. Now we've got stars and stuff. Before, it was just really boring. So these are the first things we did, and these were the lasting things that we did that made a difference in our transformation. First of all, we eliminated Carnegie units. Some of the most powerful work we did was what we eliminated. I would say in any reform effort, if you allow a dual system to exist, if you don't eliminate things, then there'll be a regression to the mean. If we didn't eliminate Carnegie units, which are built on seat time, the concept of the Carnegie units built on seat time, then our students' learning would have all been determined. We would have been talking about time. We wanted to eliminate the variable of time and have the learning be about learning and make time a variable. There's a slide about that in a second. And so we had to get rid of the Carnegie unit, and we did. which hurt a little at the time, but didn't for very long. We discreetly report out on skills and content now. You can call them learning targets or competencies or standards or whatever it is. So when a student takes an English course, we used to say English 83. And what that 83 meant was the good reader, was like a 96 reader and couldn't punctuate themselves out of a paper bag. About a 61 grammarian. And we called that an 83. Like those averages, those state averages that really are fictitious, that 83 was really fictitious too. It didn't mean that the kid knew 83% of everything that had been taught to him or her. They didn't know 83% about anything. Not any one individual item. So we broke it down into discrete areas that we called, more discrete areas, that we called standards. And we reported out on every one of those 57 discrete standards. And students had to be proficient in all 57. And that made a difference. We decided to out all of our documents around curriculum and assessment to our students. It was a goal to make sure that they knew what we knew about the curriculum and assessment system. And so in the first year, when a student went in, we started this with a freshman class. So it was really interesting for a while when we had two systems running at once. And so freshmen went in the first year, and they heard about summative and formative assessment. All summative assessments carry rubrics, and formative assessments don't. And they got into this jargon. And then they went to the sophomore year. Now, the sophomore team hadn't done this yet. So we had students with 2 years of experience and a team of teachers that had no experience. They had created the documents and done the background work. So the students rolled into the classroom, and they said, and teacher said, okay, we're going to have an assessment next week. Is it summative or formative? Summative, I guess, is summative. Where's the rubric? And teacher's like, jeez, what are we doing here? But the documents that Donna's going to talk about are designed for kids to have a constant and ongoing curriculum conversation with you. So when they say, why are we going outside to dig that hole today, they're questioning how that activity in the curriculum gets to that learning target. And they're saying, maybe there's a different way to do it. Maybe there's a more efficient way to do it. It got rid of a lot of pet projects. And those things started tumbling, and we started talking about what's going to get us to the target most efficiently. And kids were part of that conversation because of the documents being transmitted. And we did talk about eliminating averaging. We'll talk about more about that. Jerry will talk about, we talk about our grade reporting and grading. We completely grade on our rubrics now. So every school has rubrics. Probably very few schools in America would say we don't have any rubrics. And lots of schools have lots of rubrics. It is mandatory for us to have a rubric for every summative assessment in our school. Because the rubric is in replacement of the Carnegie unit. So we don't know if a student's ready to graduate or not unless we have a rubric to tell us. So it's mandatory. And that's what's different. And the rubric measures quality. Trying to get from one column of the rubric to the next is a quality assessment. It's about our grading system is now based on quality instead of what we used to do is sort and rank kids, which isn't based on quality. So what I say is, if we're going to judge surfers, we are all surfers, and we are, you know, the 50 worst surfers in the world. Someone could come in and sort and rank us. And I could be the best worst surfer in the world. And someone here could be the 50th worst surfer in the world. And the distance between us could be very small or it could be huge. And the sorting and the ranking doesn't determine any of that. You can't figure out what being the 39th worst surfer in the world means and how it compares to being the 40th worst or the first worst. So, and who cares if we're all the worst anyway, right? We should be on a rubric and saying, we all do not meet in surfing. And so that's why we went to that practice. And then the interventions came in. Just-in-time interventions. We have a whole series of interventions we'll talk to you about. But it's a net. We have a flow chart. We know and kids know, if this with the assessment, then that with the intervention. There's no mystery to it any longer. And we had to get rid of things. We had to get rid of stuff that we were doing that wasn't effective or that didn't contribute to success. It didn't have to be bad stuff, but sometimes it was just neutral stuff, which gets into pet, you know, curriculum projects and a series of other practices that we had to get rid of. And people have to be ready to get rid of things. So the standards themselves, I think, won't take but a sec. Most people know what standards are now. They're an itemized list of learning objectives. There are two of ours. The one on the left, the circle, is one that we made up. Actually, no, we stole it. we didn't make it up. We stole it. But it's not in the learning results in Maine. It's not in our state document. It's aligned to it, though. And so some of our standards are aligned to state and national standards. The one on the right, the math one, is directly out of the content standards of the learning results. What we had to decide about our standards was how big to make them, how specific or how broad. And remember, when we eliminated the Carnegie unit, that was a big question because we had very picayune specific standards, and a student didn't push the decimal to the left correctly on the third try, if that's a standard, then they're not graduating when they don't do it. So our standards had to be a combination of broad enough to give us a little wiggle room and specific enough to be able to have us intervene with kids in specific areas. So it took us a while to norm that. These are standards from our technology center we send kids. When we went to this system, and we said the technology center, two other high schools send kids there too who aren't doing standards, we said we'd like to have you report out on standards. And what they said to us was, well, thank God someone finally asked us to do that, because we've been ready to do it for like 45 years. You know, the brakes on the car don't work. You don't meet the standard. And here are a series of things you have to do to make sure the brakes work. It was always the language they spoke. They had all their stuff in place ready to go. So I kind of went in there kind of like, I don't want to ask you to do this, but, you know, it was handshaking and backslapping, and it was, they were happy about that. It was easy for them to do, much easier for them to do than for us to do. And that was the old system. Time is constant, learning is variable. That's the system under which we live. That's why 2 kids out of 20 in kindergarten will matriculate from college, a four-year college, in 17 years. Because it's not about learning. The system isn't about learning. I would contend that the system under which we currently struggle is not about learning. And we flip that formula to this. And time expands for us through interventions. That would be the caveat underneath it. Time expands through interventions. Like, how do you get more time? It expands through interventions. And we're not done with the learning experience until the learning is complete. So, okay, Don's going to take you through a set of documents. The challenge for us was to go from the broad standard to the specific measurement through a series of documents. I would say standards is a document-based system, and ultimately I would say it's a curriculum management system. A good standards-based system is a curriculum management system, I think. So
we have our broad standards that we started out with, and then everybody in the high school made up their standards-based syllabus, and that's given out to the students also. And it has the framework. So in that broad topic or broad standard, what is it that we're going to be covering? And then the lesson plans or the unit is where it gets right into the meat of the curriculum. And these are the things we're going to be doing. And then on top of that, everything has a rubric that will specifically meet those standards. So here's a social studies one. This is the broad standard, so you can see where the star is. And then we move on. Here's an example from the syllabi. There's the standard, and then we put in our frameworks.
And that's because that standard might show up in another class.
Right.
With a different different framework.
Right. Or at a different grade level, too. And then, not going too fast.
No.
I'm nervous. Oh, yellow's not a good color.
Yellow is not a good color. I didn't fix this
slide. Note to coach, take the yellow
out. Take yellow out, put
orange in. I didn't fix
in.
This slide.
Okay. What it is on that document that comes out to the kids, it says government intervention today article review. And it has a little star. That's the actual title of the assessment. So when any kid gets a document and that little asterisk is there, and then there's a design a Great Depression era museum, and there's a little star there. That's what the kids know they're going to have for an assessment.
But this slide is missing. Can you go back a second, Jerry? This slide is missing the most information. Those standards-based unit lesson plans, that's the curriculum. If you open up our curriculum books, the shelf curriculum and the taught curriculum are the same document. So kids are getting that document. That's all filled out with activities, resources. That document is a very full document, and it sets out the plan for what standards you're going to meet and how you're going to meet them over those next several weeks. That's the roadmap, and that's the curriculum document.
And for example, on one of mine, it says a bog walk, but then there is an assessment that where they go and collect the data on that bog walk that we do. So it's not just a fun ride, you know, and go walk around and look at nature. It's actually tied to my standards.
These remotes are unreliable.
And you can see this is a rubric that students would expect. And we have several cut points. We don't fill in does not meet. That's just something we all agreed on, that you need intervention at that point. This means you're almost there, obviously meets, and maybe even pushing yourself to a meets plus. Because we're heterogeneously grouped, a lot of our parents were like, how are you going to challenge our kids? You know, what happens if they don't get their 95 or 98? So we always, always include exceeds on our rubrics. And then what we do is we say there's an honors option. So if you qualify and get your work to an exceeds, then there is an honors plus. I mean, an honors option, which is a 4.5. And that's taking whatever that assessment is and applying it to the real world. It might mean you're published. It might mean you're presenting to another group of students. I had a student who did a slideshow on Rachel Carson, and she had to come up after school and present to the staff. So that was an example.
You want to talk about the 0.5s and how that works? Right, how they get a 2.5, for instance.
Oh, yeah. A 2.5, you mean by?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. What we do here is a 2, if it all falls in this category, you're hitting the 2. And in my mind as a teacher, if you get 2s on an assessment, then I really need to step up and find intervention time to help you with it. If it's a 2.5, I kind of think students need to come see me and say, can I meet with you during lab to get this fixed? And that's what we try to teach the freshmen, more responsibility. And there's a difference there. Whereas here, 3s, I always tell the kids that's my goal, but you know, if you want to challenge yourself or you want to push yourself or you want to make your mom happy, then shoot for over here. And a lot of the kids will do, you know, all of this and some of this. So that's how they get the 3.5.
They literally have a foot in each column, but that's the quality versus rank and sort document.
Right.
And there are only 7 cut points. You cannot get a 2.3. What a math teacher did that, a new math teacher to school. First thing he did, some kid came up to me and said, hey, Mr. Palmer, I got a 2.3. And he knew he couldn't get a 2.3. It's like, how do you like that?
You know, one other thing I'll just say, that for the does not meet column, it's a wonderful, I've seen teachers do this, they'll conference with students and they'll fill in that does not meet column
right.
with what the students need
right.
to do to get onto the rubric. And then they have some documentation, or they'll circle the things, or some way,
yeah.
So it's a living document for the kids to help them figure out, what do I need to do to improve my
Quite often
score.
Teachers are commenting, oh, they'll circle or highlight, we all have different color systems or whatever with the kids. What it is that would make that move to another column.
That's how that standard travels down through those 4 documents to get to a specific scorable document that can be used for graduation ultimately to determine matriculation, but also to be graded. And you started with this broad thing, and that same standard kept moving through those documents until you got to that point.
The English teachers in our school are always talking about peer edit, peer edit, peer edit. Well, you know, as a science teacher, that's not generally what I would spend my time doing. But now what I do is when a kid is ready to hand in a lab report, I'll say, have you checked your rubric? and has a peer or your lab partner checked your rubric, you know, against your product. So,
okay.
Yep.
Okay. So, so for the grading part, this is an example of chocolate and whether or not chocolate meets the standard or not. So in the standards-based world, you could have, we start here, you know, so the criteria or the standard that we're after is the student will develop a high-quality piece of chocolate. And actually, the measure of whether the degree to which they did that is whether or not it meets these criteria, these indicators. And so if they do meet both of these, they get the 3. And as Greg said, if they meet that plus maybe partially get to this, they'll get a 3.5. If they're down here at a 2 and maybe they get one of these, they get a 2.5. Or a 2, or it does not meet. So the last example pretty much illustrated the same thing, so I'm not going to belabor the point. But they do have 7 cut points, and they don't use the 101. Students must meet at the 3.0 level on all standards in order to qualify for the graduation standard. And if they don't, they have to do interventions, which we'll talk much more about in a moment. So it's based on the criteria. Their report card shows all those standards, and you can see the grades for each of the standards. So they're not averaged across those standards.
Just a quick question. We've done things like this. Two problems we ran into is, you know, the difference between a 2 and a 3 tends to be the big, you know.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, so how do you, say, calibrate all teachers around what would be sweet and creamy, for example,
right,
as
right.
opposed to bitter?
That's a great question. So one of the things that all the it's a small school,
uh-huh.
so there's one grade level team at each grade level, and they are a professional learning group, and they have team common planning time. They meet every other day. That's one of their assigned blocks, and every week they do professional learning group activities. For the first year, all of the ninth grade teachers, all they ever did was bring their assignments, student work that was, they might have graded, but they take the grades off, and their rubrics, and they would score them together in a protocol. And they spent a lot of time doing that, and then trying to adjust the language of their rubrics. And that remains a continuous process. I mean, because constantly refining as they learn more, as they get more ideas about how to be better precision makers with the language, they do that. But what it also does is inform the entire team, all 4 content areas, plus special education, about what the kids are doing in each other's classrooms. And that's a huge benefit for when they have interventions. So even if the intervention that you have is with a teacher who's not the content teacher, they have a clear understanding about the targets and what that summative assessment is about, and that it's a greater way to support each other.
And do you create your own assessments, and do you
yes.
have a reliability, you know, authenticity training or something? We ran into some of that ourselves when we were creating the instruments.
Yeah, we do create our own. Our own assessments, but we have, you know, we use the reliability measures we're given, the PSAT and the SAT,
mm-hmm.
And so what we're it's all PLC work, and we talked about that. We talked about sort of benchmarking with assessments that were created, you know, were normed by people other than us, and ultimately what we decided was to stick with. Teacher-constructed assessments. We have one grade-level teacher, like Dawn's teaching all Earth and Environmental Science to all ninth grade kids. So she's norming that with everybody else, but we didn't go to outside normed assessments. What we said was, let's see how we do, and we'll talk about how we did and see if by doing it ourselves, if we fell down and we were missing the target, or if we were able to construct assessments. We reasoned we'd be able to construct assessments that would hit the target.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll talk about more.
The science department does pull the old MEAs, the 11th graders
oh, yeah.
used to have
sure.
that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have the old questions and use those too.
So
this is a classic example. I don't know if any of you have read O'Connor, but so which student would you choose to pack your parachute? And this is a classic example of standards-based grading. So if you looked at these, and this gets into the whole idea of trending. And that's the other part of this grading and assessment process that they do. So there is an algorithm where it weights the grades. So it's focusing on mastery. So how does a student fare over time with assessments that measure a standard? And in this case, you can see that these students have all different scores at the beginning and at the end. But if you look at it, who would you want to pack your parachute?
Student B.
How many would say student B? How many would say something else? Yes.
So I'll be Vanna White. So student A, these are just assessments on the parachute, how good a job they've done packing it. Outstanding, terrible, outstanding, terrible, outstanding, terrible, outstanding, you're jumping next. So that's they're incredibly erratic in taking the assessment on how to pack that parachute effectively. That's what the chart shows. So you don't know what they're going to do next time. You can't predict it because they're all over the place. This is what B does. That's out not too good. And grows. The next time they pack it, we assume they're going to be somewhere here.
And that's what the algorithm does, is it predicts future assessment scores for students.
Right. And by the way, the average of all of those is a 70. They all average to 70.
Right. So in another world, you'd never know who knew the most in that paradigm. Yes, sir.
Not John.
So in your grading system, that I can't see too well.
Yeah.
But the top right-hand corner.
Yeah.
What would the final assessment be in your system?
So we would do it this way. Let's say you and I take a multiplication class. We take five assessments, and we score the same. They go 0, 40, 60, 80, 100. Those are our assessments. The final 100 was a test over all of our multiplication. We both knew multiplication cold at the end of the experience. Your grades are averaged. Mine are trended. You get a 52. I would get about a 90.
Yeah.
That's a difference.
So it rewards mastery.
Right. Rewards
growth. End of,
rewards growth.
Right, at the end of the experience.
And the reverse is true. If the assessments went 100, 80, 60, 40, 0, and we averaged them, 52, I'd get a 20 or a 10.
It sounds very logical.
Yeah.
So here's an example.
If that was accessible to your community.
We're still standing.
And
here.
And the school board approved the policy. So in this case, you can see here it starts out as it does not meet, moves from a 2 to a 2.5 to a 4. So the student is showing growth and getting better on the assessments. It's a 3.5, but in this system, if it were averaged, that score would be a 2.125. And at the bottom, it starts out high, but then somehow this student isn't showing progress. They're going the other way, and they do worse on their assessments over time. The final score is it does not meet, and if it were averaged, it would still be a 2.125. So it's not really showing what's happening for students in this system of averaging. Yes, sir.
But how likely is it that a student will show a trend of that nature? Do you see that?
This is an extreme example.
No,
the second one.
I think, yes. My question is, it's easy to see the extreme distinctions between standards and averages, but it seems quite a bit less likely that you would see many students who have such a downward trend as that.
Right.
In practice,
it looks more like the Dow Jones Stock Exchange. It looks more like this.
Right.
But you have enough assessments, and the algorithm still determines the trend. The key word is trend. I mean, there are many more assessment numbers in for any student on any standard than those. But you do see that sometimes. Every assessment, the interesting thing about this is every reporting system has a bias. In averaging, how many kids do you have who hit December in geometry and say, I'm done? I'm not a great math student, but I've added it up. I know if I get 100 in every test for the rest of the year, I get a 60. I'm done. I'll sit in the seat. I will or will not behave. I'm done. In trending, that doesn't happen. Kids know in December, they are not done. How many times do you think kids in our school now blow off finals? Never. And they hate that. In the past, they used to. You would get the kid who'd get out the calculator and say, I know if I get a zero on my final, I'm passing. I don't care that much about this course. That happened to us. On the other end of the extreme, if you want to game this system, what do you do in the early assessments?
Not you tank.
So our answer to that is interventions. You tank on an early assessment, you're in interventions. The other way you can do it is give them a 3 at the beginning of the every year and every standard, and it kills that opportunity. You start out the year with a 3, and you can't do that.
But. Okay. So here's an example of a standards-based report card where there are 5 standards in English, and these are the student's scores, and these two would send a student to intervention.
But that's not averaging down.
Right, they're not averaging down, so each of those is reported out on the report card. So you don't get a final grade in English.
So would that mean that in the 3.0, 3.5 on the 4 that the student got, they're done with that now?
Well,
they just have to work on the 2.5 and the 2?
Well, that's where they are right now. And a standards-based system is interesting. We started, our report card started with 4 columns, because our old report card had 4 columns. And we quickly realized, no, that doesn't make any sense. The curtain doesn't come down at the end of the first quarter. That just isn't logical in a trended grade. Because in an average grade, you got a 60 first quarter. Now you're starting over again. Everything's a progress report. So now all of our report cards have 1 column, just like that. That might be September. That report card might be November. So though they're still trending on these, but they're okay right now. The trend could still go down or up.
So this would be in your language arts class, whatever class this is.
Yeah.
These are the 5 things that we are going to work on for the year or for whenever. And
yeah.
The goal is to get 3, 3.5, or 4
right.
In each one of these.
Absolutely.
On a consistent basis.
Absolutely.
Correct.
Yes.
And,
absolutely.
And yeah. Within each of these standards are their performance indicators, the specific measurable objectives that they are using with their rubrics and their assessments to demonstrate that they have met this broader standard. And so that's where the classroom assessments and the classroom work come in to get to that point.
If they meet, I know our kids will ask this question immediately. If they meet, do they get to then stop?
No. Well, no, because these standards are the same for 9 through 12, right?
Uh-huh.
The thing that's different is that those performance indicators demonstrate more depth and sophisticated, skills.
It's the stair metaphor.
That's
piece.
Right. That's right.
No, frameworks in the syllabus are the steps that indicate, in this course, that standard means this.
Yes.
So the previous slide when you were showing the trend versus the average,
yeah.
Those individual grades, were they all different assessments
yeah.
that
yes.
were assessing that?
They were
student?
Different. Yeah, all those
right.
grades went to this trend.
So
for instance.
To go from a 4 to a doesn't meet at all, those weren't the same assessment. They were all different.
All
were
different assessments.
Different assessments
right.
assessing the same standard.
Okay.
Right. So that pattern of assessments determines each one of those. And we said earlier, this demonstrates it. You know, a kid is a good reader. Can't punctuate their way out of a paper bag. We're going to work on this in intervention.
So you can't escape knowing the material and being able to demonstrate the skills.
Resistance is futile is our motto.
That's right. Yep. Yep. Let's
failure.
There may be lots of questions. I'm not sure what I've
talking failure, too. We are about 10 past.
Okay.
So we need to move.
Okay. So we can we just move a little bit, and then we'll come back to this? So now we're going to talk about the interventions.
Okay. I don't know which slide we're showing. Oh, okay. This is skill-based intervention, and basically the 9th graders are in FAME, which is a literacy, and it's viability, and all of the 9th graders are in FAME. F and A are
close to non-reading.
Non-reading, yeah. M is on level, and E is...
M is kind of middle, M for middle school, really. It's
right.
about reading levels, about grade 6, 7, and 8. E is on or above grade level.
And we use the E as an enrichment for those kids.
But that way, all kids are in that intervention, every single student in our school.
So now when freshmen come to the high school, they don't get gym and phys ed and art and music. They have less choice, but they have FAPE. Also, ninth and 10th graders are in ALEX for part of their week. Freshmen have 40 minutes every other day, and ALEX is an online program for math skills, and it takes every student where you are, tests you, and pushes you further, so you're building your skills, whether you're at the point where you have to learn your multiplication facts, or whether you're pushed into trigonometry or geometry as a freshman. So that happens to everybody. And then 10th graders have a block of time during their day where they all are using A+, which is another program that, and it's grammar, basically. We have one-to-one computers in our school, so that's why we use those. Then Plato is also an online program that it's a tutorial, and it's good for content. And
Greg, we talked to them.
Yeah, Greg mentioned earlier about how if I had a kid that didn't pass, I have a standard that says students will learn earth processes. Well, I have several things in that they have to hit. And several of my kids, I don't know what you want to say, blew it off, didn't show up, decided that baseball was more important, and they failed the weather unit. So instead of me failing them for the year, they went to our summer academy, which we'll talk about in a minute, and they did that on Plato.
So folks know, these are in addition to core courses. So it's ALEX plus math. It's FAME and A+, plus English. They're in addition to, not instead of.
So some of the things we gave up were some of our elective classes that we dearly loved to teach, but for a good cause.
And these are scheduled into your day?
Scheduled
yes.
into our day.
Yes.
Yeah, they absolutely are.
And then we have levels of intervention. During the school, we have effort-based ones. Our lab is like the old-fashioned study hall, except that it's not a study hall. All of the ninth grade teachers, or actually any grade level you're in, they're on a team, and those teachers are made available. So in lab, I might have 10 kids assigned to me, but if they need to go see the math teacher to redo or finish up a geometry test, I can write them a pass and they go do that. We use iChat on our laptops, so instead of sending kids, a lot of kids love to travel in the ninth grade, we can chat over and say, Gail, do you need Dusty to finish up that social studies project? We also have an academic period during lunch. One of the things that I got to give up was lunch duty. Yay. And so now I get to actually teach during lunch. I have kids, there's times when they get a pass and they'll come in. Every other day we have lunch intervention. And it's only for time where you need one-on-one with a teacher. And so I get to do some tutoring a little bit in those blocks. We move up to guided study, block 5, and academies. Guided study, got to give up detention duty. We don't have detention duty anymore. That's covered by the office. Guided study is you are assigned for a week, and kids that need to do something that didn't get it done or whatever, you sign them to guided study, and there's a teacher that will monitor that. Block 5, if you get we're a 4-block period. If you get assigned to block 5, that's an after school with me. Block 5 is more instruction with the teacher that needs you. And then academies, we run a fall, winter, and spring academy. And basically, that's a bigger block of time after school. We have a special bus that takes everybody home. And if you get put in academy, you have to go. You can't go to your basketball practice because the coach knows there's academies going on. And so that goes until 4 o'clock, so it's a big chunk of time. Teachers are there for the first 40 minutes, half an hour.
Yeah.
You get the kids started on, like, I would sit and say, look, your lab report, this is, you forgot the conclusion. Get that done. And so then they would go into a room that would be monitored for the last hour. And then the extensive interventions is when all of these aren't working. And we have an SAT, student assistant team, and we have to look at maybe the schedule's too heavy for a freshman. They can't handle it. They might need to be pulled out of French and focus on math so they get into a guided study.
It all plays out in a flow chart, just to give people a sense that it's systematized. The skill-based interventions run down the side with bars, and these are the effort-based interventions. Another way of saying it, I think, is that one of the reasons kids don't meet standards is they don't have the skills to meet standards. So it's incumbent on us to help get them those skills, ergo the skill-based interventions. And all of those interventions, like we said before, are for everybody. The effort-based interventions are another reason kids don't meet standards is because they don't have the time and space, quiet space at home. They don't do homework. A whole series of issues. They've been out sick. One thing I like about our system is we don't care what the reason is. We don't care that you didn't do your homework because you dislike the principal. We don't care that you didn't do your homework because you just forgot. We don't care that you didn't do your homework. When I say this, the do not care is about, the system works the same. We don't care that a grandparent passed away. We care. But the system reacts the same way to all those things. The system doesn't judge. You don't like the principal, you're not going to be able to make it up. It doesn't. The system doesn't care. No one needs a note for this system. All the system acknowledges is the assessments aren't complete. That's it. And so it goes from short cycle that day to longer cycle that week to longer cycle that's quarterly to the longest cycle once a year in our summer academy. And so the interventions become longer cycle and more amounts of time when students enter them in those longer cycles, depending on how they're doing. And they get out of the system whenever they're done the work.
The freshmen right now don't know anything different about the intervention, so they don't think it's a bad word. You know, it's just, that's where I'm going to go get some help. And even the brightest gifted kid I have in my class, he works, but he works slowly. And he's like, I'll finish this in lunch intervention, see you then. Okay, because the deadline, it's due on a certain time, and he knows he's not going to make it. So.
And what if they don't make it by the deadline?
Well,
do they score lower and then?
Yep. Yep, it gets reported, and then quite often what happens is they will get an invitation to academy where we will look at that again because they need to learn the information. So I either got to figure out a different way to teach them the material for their learning style or whatever it is, or I need to sit with them and figure out what the problem was, why they didn't learn it, why they didn't do so well. And if they come to academy, that's great, but sometimes it's coming in summer academy, and summer academy can be as long as 15 minutes or all of the days, which adds up to about 3.5 weeks of school.
And they're done. But the answer to your question is no. I think Don misheard the question.
Oh, sorry.
Do they score lower because it's later? No.
No.
No, what I meant was that, so they haven't completed the assignment,
uh-huh.
or they haven't done the assignment.
Uh-huh.
On the rubric, they would, I mean, if it's not there, obviously it's...
Right, it does not meet.
Does not meet
until they complete it.
Right.
Sure.
And then... And you'll accept it at any point because the whole philosophy is to learn the material.
Yeah.
Freshman teachers are probably more flexible with that because we're getting middle school kids in. And that's one of the issues that we struggle with at our school is, are we preparing kids for college if they're not meeting deadlines? And, you know, it's a constant conversation at our school about deadlines because we're so into giving... Not now, but we were so into giving, you know, bonus points if you hand it in early.
Right, no bonus.
And then minus points if you hand in late. Well, it's not about late or early. It's about the work. We have created, like the science department, we have a school-wide participation rubric. And the science department, I think the math has started doing it now, we changed it just a little bit to tweak science. You know, like following safety rules and whatnot. So that is being assessed now, if your work is handed in on time. But it's about participating in a science community.
It's measured separately.
It's measured separately.
But the answer is that if a kid, if this doesn't catch a student, a
because there's a, we're talking about hundreds of interventions when a student gets done with this. If it doesn't catch a student, they're at risk. They're socially, and we have found, it's a good assessment for if they're socially and emotionally at risk. So the, we don't have kids just constantly going off. I mean, because they know we're going to catch them up again, we're going to catch them, we're going to keep after them. It tells us that there's more going on, and almost always is. So you get down to smaller and smaller percentages of kids. We have 200 kids in our school. We started Summer Academy last summer. On day one, we had 70 students. Day two, we had 50. Day three, we had about 41. On day 17, we had about 6. Kids were really, really, really at risk. So you saw this chart before, just reminding you of it. This was our SAT scores in 05, 06, and 06, 07. Just go down here. 40%. 40% economic disadvantage, 40% did not meet, zip code.
Oh.
And we're happy you came.
I missed something there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And how do you do the academies?
It's a good question. We'll talk about it. Okay, math. A little worse, actually. So we were doing worse than our economic disadvantage would have suggested back then. Writing. Right on the money. We did a little better that year, a little bit. So these are PSAT results. We were tracking those pretty closely. The class of 2008 was 2 years prior to us ending this system, our old system. The P's are our school, the line is the nation, and the red X's are the state of Maine. You can see what we were, and that was pretty typical of us. It actually wasn't too bad for students in our school to be only that far behind the state average. This was our last traditional class. Same PSAT, and you can see where those P's fall. They did a little better, and I want to say before we go about, you can go to the next slide here. So before we do the next one, the class of 2009 scored equivalent to the class of 2010 in middle school testing on the NEA, which is equivalent to the NECAP. Those two classes, you couldn't slip a piece of paper between them. I think if anyone were to make a final judgment about those two classes, they would say the class of 2009 was slightly more academically able than the class of 2010. So we did all this stuff, and that was the class of 2010 when they PSAT. That was the difference. And we saw those kind of differences in math and in writing as well. So this is hard to see from there. These are our SAT results from 2 years. 2007-2008 was when our graduating class of 2009 took the SATs in the spring. And this is our first standards-based class. And so here you go down to does not meet in reading. There's your 40%, 44. Then it was 29 for the first standards-based class. Math, 44, went down to 28. Writing, 33, went down to 19. And science, 56 to 43. That has improved quite a bit since then, too. But when you look at that chart really closely, the class of 08 or 09 improved a huge amount. The class of 2010, they took the SAT. You can go ahead to the next one.
So
yeah.
Sample sizes are around 50 students?
These sample sizers are 50 to 60 kids. Yeah. So that's what we improved over a 3-year span on the SAT.
Average.
Yeah, combined average of math and reading went up 20% in 3 years, which is the biggest increase of any high school in the state of Maine over that 3-year span. Yeah.
Earlier you had mentioned the tie, the zip code thing, the socioeconomic piece, and the free reduced lunch, or whoever you talked about. Did you break it out and notice more of a growth trend in that particular subgroup, or was it across the board?
It was across the board, but the thing about our school is our kids, they were scoring low, but they were scoring equivalently low to kids in other schools who were in that category. So a student who was economically disadvantaged in Searsport was scoring pretty equivalent to a student who was economically disadvantaged in Camden, which is a huge socioeconomic difference. The kids who weren't performing equivalently were our high performers. They were the high performer in Searsport was you could drive a semi between them and the high performer in Camden, and they didn't know that. But that's why interventions were for everybody. The kids in our school perceive themselves to be higher performers. Like, why do we have to do this? And the quiet answer was, because you have more ground to make up than anyone else in this school. So they actually gained more than anybody, and they actually started to approach their peers, high-performing peers in other schools. That was the biggest growth, actually. It was odd. It was interesting. We're still working on the kids who are struggling more.
How did you get parents on board? How did you share the language that we were speaking
to? Well, a couple of things were true in Searsport. One is things had gotten pretty tough. By the mid-90s, we were in every bad category that you could find. You know, maybe might be minus ethics. I think we were decent people still, but aside from that, things were pretty tough. So there was the logic that why not, right? We changed a lot of things, and when people said, "Why are you doing that?" Well, show me the data that we should maintain something that we're doing. That was one issue. But still, people were mad at us because all those things are about tradition.
Excuse me.
People didn't want to lose the 0 to 100 point scale, so we had to have all those conversations with folks. And we employed the tactic that we just made people mad and they came in to complain. And so that worked out pretty well. But we did all the community forums and the mailings and all that stuff. I want to address the question about resources. The way we employed our resources morphed quite a bit. So the teachers figured out that intervention system. They said, this will work, and this will work, and this will work. So we gave up other duties to have teachers do academic stuff with kids. We eliminated electives. We still have electives. We have a healthy amount of electives. But I would say we were an elective-driven school prior to, and we are core-driven school now. We used to teach sports literature, don't teach it anymore. Used to teach feminist literature, don't teach it anymore. Used to teach a class called World Traveler, no more.
But we teach forensics.
Teach forensics, which we do. We have some really good electives, but I could list, I could write on the wall, I could fill a half of one of these walls with the electives that we no longer teach, because those teachers now are working on interventions with kids. We put our balls into that particular basket of interventions. And I think if I were to draw like a consistent theme from this, all these sessions, it was a theme in the session that we attended here, it would be the theme of interventions. And you have to make sacrifices. You have to bite the bullet and give some stuff up. I would say that was like a key for us. We were willing to give stuff up.
I would say the
wanted.
Second key was the PLCs with our team members, because looking at a rubric in science, I think I've done a pretty good job. But then when I shared it with my ninth grade English teacher and math teacher, they were also looking through it through the eyes of the student, and they're like, "Don, this doesn't make sense. What, you know, how do I get this?" And so that kind of support was awesome, and you could bring people along. Somebody called somebody a grungeon or something. In the last one I went to, I'm like, "Wait, I'm a 25-year veteran. That's not right." And but that PLC helped teachers move along too. A lot of support.
Yeah, critical.
Yes, she had a question, and then this gentleman.
How did you determine the specific 58 standards that a student needs to meet to graduate?
To be honest, it was a blast, and it was before. No one else had a list of graduation standards for us. We asked. First we thought we'd just rip somebody else off, but no one had that full list. And the reason in the main, every time a new graduation policy comes up around standards, people always ask the same thing, what standards? And so they point to the learning results, but they don't have an itemized list of standards that kids have to meet to graduate, and it always goes down for that reason. So we just created it. Our board gave us 2 days, the only time that's ever happened in our district, 2 days that weren't planned on for professional development. Kids stayed home. And we came into a room, and I challenged people. I said, I'm gonna send you back to your content area teams. So math's going to go with math, and science with science, English with English, social studies, health and PE, the arts, everybody. And here are some documents. We have the learning results, our state learning stuff. And here's some national standards and criteria, and find anything else you want other than those two documents. Come back in 2 hours with a list of, if you can't do or know this in this content area, you shouldn't be able to graduate. Draw lines in the sand for me. And so they all went out. In 2 hours, it was like a drill. Got to be back here in 2 hours to show something to some to us all. And so people came back and shared that. English had very broad standards. Math was like a standard, pick the pencil up and move it 3/4 of an inch to the right. That were their standards. They had about 400 of them. And we said, all right, our standards all have to look alike. So everyone presented the standards. We talked about that. We normed it. It was kind of like PLC. And after talking about it, everybody agreed on one standard from one content area, just one, that they thought was about the right focus. Knowing we were going to get rid of the Carnegie unit, that gave us a little flexibility, but was still a specific enough target that we could do something with it to help intervene with kids. And everybody, I said, okay, everyone write that standard down. Now go back again, and I'll see you in an hour. Rewrite your standards, trying to get the same level of focus into your standards.
There's also the movement about power standards. I don't know if you've heard of that terminology or not, but that's a great reference for helping schools to narrow down to, like, what's really essential at the end of the day for kids to be able to know and do, those enduring understandings. Sir, you had a question.
I was just wondering, some very good information here, but at the end of 4 years, you've got students who are going to be applying to colleges. How's this being received by college admissions? And secondly, do you have an example of what your transcript looks like?
We do have a great transcript, and we had to develop it. Around the third year, we'll post. We're going to post all of our materials on the website. Might be able to find it? Okay, good. So around the third year of this, when kids were juniors, my guidance department came and said, so, Greg, you know, we thought since we're doing all this standards-based stuff, we might have... a transcript? They're like, oh yeah, transcript. So we developed a transcript with our software people, and we now own part of the rights to that transcript because they'll sell it to other schools that are standards-based. So we have a very nice transcript that reports our own standards in a logical way that's not too long. And the answer is, you know, that's the first thing parents said was, this is a great system, but how come you don't want our kids to go to college? Because no one's going to take them. And so... It's fine. More kids are going to college before. This is the senior year. Our kids are applying and getting into colleges. And colleges kind of giggled. They said, so you think that you've created something we haven't seen? You know, we get transcripts that grade kids based on bananas and pineapples. And we have to figure out what that means. If you're giving us a score, which we did, give them a score. And all of that, we thought about just going with does not meet, partially meets, and exceeds. We said, no, we got to put a number to it. So that's when we came up with those 7 cup points. Is that you're going to give us a number that will represent how kids did on the work you gave them, we're good. And so it's been fine.
My son goes to college in California, and 4 years ago when he was applying as a freshman there, they did not want to know, the colleges in California, that he had a 97 overall average in high school. They wanted it converted to the 1 through 4. Where does that put him for that college?
Thank you.
So.
We can create a GPA and all that stuff. It's interactive. We can bring up the GPA and then click and make it disappear so kids don't see it. We can pull up a class rank and click and make it disappear so kids don't see it. So we don't rank kids anymore. We don't have a 1 through whatever list. But if they have a scholarship and they say, I need my class rank for this scholarship, we'll say, fill it all out, give it to us, give us the envelope. We'll click up, we'll write down what number they are, seal the envelope, and mail it. So we can create all those things and we can make them disappear.
Is that how you do it for, like, National Honor Society or anything like that?
Yeah, it is how we do it for NHS and that kind of thing. It is, yeah.
What's your gas system?
Well, we use a company called Abante Progression, is what it's called. It's a very big, broad, open data system. You really have to create, you have to customize. It's a lot of work to customize it. It was good for us because we were really doing something that didn't really exist. And so, but now they have a bazillion of them that are a little more pre-formatted. Abante is a lot of effort to make it work, but we got there and it works now. And it's a standards-based system. They had the trending thing. So we did this for a year, and I said, do you have a trending function? Because they are specifically a standards-based reporting module. And they said, hold on a second. And they looked, they said, yeah, but we've never turned it on. We're like, well, fire it up, and let's see how it works. And so I think we're still the only school that works with them that uses that system. But they can customize that, too.
But the entire state is going to Infinite Campus,
right.
And they are also working on standards-based designs because some other schools in Maine are using it. So that may well be a good one for Searsport.
Yeah.
Other questions that people have? Yes, sir.
What is the conversation like between our high school and middle school?
Well, that's interesting. So I've been the high school principal for 8 years, and there was a middle school principal. We have an adjoined building. The middle school principal took a job and moved to North Carolina, and the school board made me the principal of both schools. And so now I can hang a sign on the door and say, you know, he's, Mr. Palmer's, don't interrupt, he's meeting with the middle school principal. and so though we have some disagreements, we've worked most of them out. Our district has kind of done it backwards. Most districts start out with standards-based stuff at the elementary level. It might trickle up to the middle school, and the high school will stand with its arms pretty tightly folded across its chest. And so we did it first, and now it's moved back into the middle school and moving back into the elementary school. So now, with all those interventions Don talked about, FAME and Alex, now it's grade 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. So by the time our 6th grade class gets to the SATs, they will have doubled up on math through numeracy intervention for 4, 5, 6 years.
Someone else had a question?
I just had a question about bus and transportation, extra cost.
Well, we found that the busing was one of the less expensive items in that the district was willing to help us out with that. We already had a late bus, it's our elementary run, and the kids could already ride that, but then these extra buses, like for academy, it's only quarterly, or in the summer, it's only for a month, and we've been okay. It's worked out all right. That's been a cost that the district has incurred and was willing to incur. But we use the existing bus runs, and we just built off that.
Walk scheduling?
Yes. Every other day, though. It's an alternating block. Four blocks a day every other day.
So you're not teaching your language arts on a daily basis or math on a daily basis?
Every other day. Yeah.
80 minutes
every other day.
80.
Yeah, 80 minutes.
But on those alternating days, isn't that one FAME and Alex?
Yeah, so you have math on one day, math intervention on the next day. Math intervention.
So those effort-based or skill-based, I'm sorry, the skill-based interventions are happening on the alternate day. So they are having experience with that content, albeit it's not the English class.
I don't want to say credits, but you've got 20 experiences that you have to graduate.
Well, it's funny. We never did get to the graduation policy.
Yeah,
which
I handed out to everyone for your purview.
So take a look at it. But it's a little hard. It's deceptively similar to a traditional graduation policy, but it's got a lot of other implications there. So I would say we could say that we have 22 or 23. In reality, it plays out a little differently. At the end of the day, kids have to meet those 57 standards. It looks like what's happening is, and one of the things that graduation policy will indicate is that most systems are course-based systems. You have, you know, you take the course. We would say, I think, that the courses are like a vitamin pill, a concentrated way to get standards, a really efficient, concentrated way to get standards. But there are other ways to get standards, other ways to get vitamins than taking a vitamin pill. And so courses are a great way to meet standards, but you'll see in the policy, if you read it, it opens up the door to meet those standards in many different ways. So how many more experiences do you need to meet a standard in science rather than taking a science course? Depends on what those experiences are. But it opens up that door. And so if you're going to just take courses, yeah, we're 23, 24.
So I'm just looking at your schedule. If your ninth grade person coming in is taking, so you've got 8 periods that you can use.
We do.
Okay, so you've got your math, your science, your language arts, and your social studies.
Correct. They take phys ed in the freshman year, so add that on.
And you've got
lab.
How many interventions?
So add on phys ed.
Yeah.
Then they have lab. Out of lab, they take on their Alex intervention. They all have FAME, and they have room for one elective in the freshman year.
They all have FAME, no choice.
They all have FAME, no choice. We place them based on the NUIAs in the 8th grade.
And remember that for those students who are up, who are
one
higher up,
one
it's an enrichment rather than an intervention.
Yes.
Or a language.
I'm curious as to how this affects students in and out of your district.
It's been, it's been okay. You know, the more difficult thing, we teach world history in the junior year. Everybody else teaches in the freshman year. That's a bigger deal than this. It really is. We should talk about rearranging world history. So we've created conversion charts for students who move in and out.
Do you see a difference in your dropout rate or behavioral pattern?
Dropout rate's gone down, and discipline and suspensions have gone down. Dropout rate went down quite a bit in the first couple of years and has leveled off
And that we have many, many fewer suspensions than we used to have. I'm not sure there are correlations there, but those numbers have improved.
So I do believe we're at the end of our experience together. So I want to thank you very much.